Recorded live in downtown... What?
Continue.
Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. Actually, mostly movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to Season 1, Episode 9 of Rancho Notorious. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me at Rancho Notorious tonight are...
Kaylee Carruthers.
Hey Kaylee, how you doing?
Good.
And also joining us here tonight is Mark Rolston, perhaps better known to some of you as TinRibs27 on Twitter, and a longtime friend of...
The podcast that shall not be named.
Yeah, exactly. the one that we don't talk about.
No, but it was great, and thank you for making it happen.
Yeah, indeed. So, Mark, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thanks, Dan. It's really good to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, we've got a lot to talk to you about, including a website that you manage. You're also going to help us review the new Rock movie, Hercules, a little bit later on, and also get your feedback about the Wellington branch of the New Zealand International Film Festival, of which you have seen a great deal. So there's lots to include you with on the show today. Also on the show, we have an interview with Glenn Kenny, former deputy editor of Premiere Magazine and a writer in New York, who's just released a book called Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and that's in all good bookshops now, so we'll be talking to him about that a little bit later on. But before we get into all of that, we should just do our usual sort of... cast the net around our social media profiles and social media presences. Kaylee, you've been monitoring the mailbag.
Yeah, can I just start out this segment by saying that you two look so dapper. And I'm like in jeans that are rolled up with stripy socks and a sweater. I feel like I missed the memo this week.
I have to say, yes, I'm wearing a tie, yes, but... you know, you don't look like you have missed the memo. You don't look like you haven't made an effort. You do.
Oh, okay. Just it's an Angora sweater. It's nice.
Yeah, we should. I'd hate to think that we are destroying people's. You know, because we will have sound pictures of what Rancho Notorious is like and what we are like. Some people have no, you know, don't know what we look like.
No.
So it's a simple matter of a beard and glasses to look dapper, I think. Yeah.
Indeed, that seems to work. Go to work on that, Kaylee.
I'll work on it. To the mailbag, the Burkas, a two-word review from NZIF, cold in July, tepid execution. Ooh. Shout out to me from Fred Thompson, one of the most prolific two-word reviewers that we've ever clapped our eyes upon Twitter.
He's amazing.
Yeah. Kaylee pronouncing Hercules like Mama Clump from The Nutty Professor. Win. Hashtag Hercules, Hercules, Hercules. So there you go. Thank you for noticing. It's really hard not to do it. Geekboy73 made a great effort trying to do live tweet while listening to the podcast, but then tweeted about how he also failed. So
yeah, I think what happened there was that he had high hopes of giving us real-time feedback about our failings, and we were so awesome that he wasn't able to do it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, I was following along with that at the time, but it would have been nice to be able to listen to it as he was doing it.
Well, maybe we'll do that next time. You know, the intention at some point in the future is for this to be an actual live streamed event, so that if you come home from work at 6:30 on a Thursday night, you could tune into us.
Sure, it's a nice time. Get a hashtag going.
Yeah,
definitely.
I bet you anything, my mum would stay up late to listen to it live. And Reese Pie says, did I just detect Dan Slevin trying to sneakily reintroduce the two-word review without formal announcement?
Yeah, pretty much. And nice. And look, let's just put this baby to rest right now. The two-word review is back. The two-word review, because everyone's still doing it.
He's wearing a tie and purple pants, people. It's official. It's back.
It has to be back. even though I am the world's worst two-word reviewer, you guys are all fantastic, and so we need to keep that on.
Yeah.
I will say that as per the tradition of two-word reviews, a certain amount of latitude is given in terms of punctuation and...
it's all about...
We cheat. We cheat a lot.
It's all about the hyphens, people.
And we got a whole lot of two-word reviews by email. Do you have those?
Oh, we did.
Yeah.
Give me a moment.
Yeah, because I'm trying to find them on this computer.
Has somebody been saving them up?
No, there's they did a whole lot of film festival ones, and they were really good as well. And it was very impressive. Setting aside the two-wordness of the reviews, the fact that they'd been to all of these films was really good too. He said, see if I erase you. Have you found it?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, these are all from Simon Buckenberg.
A new correspondent to the show.
Yes. And in the email, says, "Hi, Rancho Notorious. Loving the new podcast. I've been doing some two-word reviews."
That's my favorite bit.
Two-word reviews of the film festival on my Letterboxd. And he links to the Letterboxd bit. So we will add that link to the show notes. So I thought I'd send some through. The Skeleton Twins, Morbid Laughs. Why Don't You Play in Hell? Whimsical Gore. Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy? Cartoon Philosophy. Housebound. Gleeful Terror. Welcome to New York. Gerard Grunts. Watchers of the Sky. Hauntingly Affecting. First Cousins Once Removed. Memory Maladies. Beauty and the Beast. Stockholm Syndrome. Leviathan. Depressing Inevitability. Looking forward to the rest of this season. Cheers, Simon.
Well, Simon, you have set a standard for yourself.
I feel like we need to have some sort of like two-word review battle between Fred and Simon now.
Yeah, we
live
can.
Live event. It'd be like...
It's like a dance-off, only with two-word reviews.
Yeah, it would be great.
Right, that's the mailbag, and thank you very much to everybody for getting in touch with us and feeding those through. If you do like the show, if you're enjoying what you're hearing, I'll tell you what is super good is if you go to iTunes and give us a rating and give us a review there, because, you know, it's kind of old-fashioned, but iTunes still pays attention to that stuff when it promote stuff to the front page. So yeah, it would be really good if we could do that. What have people been going to see this weekend? I know that the International Film Festival in Wellington finished on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That would be right, wouldn't it? And Christchurch was in its first weekend. So it'll be interesting. You know, I would imagine that box office would be sort of a little bit flatter because of that. But what was the New Zealand top five?
Opening at number five, The 100-Foot Journey. Staying steady at number four, Hercules. At number
The 100-Foot Journey. Sorry, she just butt in there.
Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren with a French accent. I've seen the trailer for it. Haven't seen the actual film itself yet. It's I don't know. I will have to see it because
it's cooking or something. Right?
It's cooking. It's food. It's about French food versus Indian food. An Indian restaurant opens across the road from a once Michelin starred. Fine dining establishment, and of course clashes of culture and culinary
prowess.
Oh, you're so good. Anyway, all of that ensues. We shall talk about that at some point in a future show.
Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie, gets bumped from the number one spot down to three. At two, up from three, The Dark Horse.
That's a fantastic effort. I think The Dark Horse is turning into one of those films that all New Zealanders feel that they sort of have to see. It's becoming one of those what is sauce sort of movies that, you know, you
what?
You know, it's like, you know, you're not what a real, you're sauce? Not a, yeah, you're not a real Kiwi unless you, you know, it's what is tomato sauce or.
I think it'd be more that you're really letting yourself down if you haven't seen it.
Well, there is that, but I think that people are feeling like, you know, it's part of being Kiwi now. You know, like boy did that. Yeah, boy did that a few years ago, and it's been a while since we've had a New Zealand film that the people feel like they've got to go to. And the fact that it's actually, you know, doing better week on week is fantastic.
And in the number one position, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, with an extraordinary amount of money in the New Zealand context, $1.5 million in box office this week, which is makes it $2 million after 2 weeks. And the first week on release was only in sneak previews. It was only on two sessions a day across the weekend. So, yeah, fantastic effort there. I think next we've got Australia. We're going to have a look across the ditch. And number five, And So It Goes, which is Michael Douglas, I think. And where did that one? That one actually went, came straight in at number six in New Zealand. So not far off the top five, well, obviously. And so it goes at number five. Hercules at number four, down from two. The 100-Foot Journey in at number three in Australia. Lucy, which we still have yet to see here.
It opens next week.
Next week, yep. So Lucy, ScarJo, down from number one after only a week. And then Guardians of the Galaxy, number one in Australia too. That's just the four-day weekend.
I'm not sure which...
This is the US, I think.
The US one, yeah. Okay. That's what I was going to guess.
Because it's got lots of numbers on it.
Yeah, okay.
Huge detail.
Yes. Number five, Lucy. Number four, The 100-Foot Journey. Three, Into the Storm? Question mark?
Oh, Into the Storm is that is the disaster movie.
It's a big tornado movie, yeah.
Yeah, it is. The tornadoes get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Is it the new Twister?
It's got Richard Armitage in it, the... I didn't
see him in the trailers.
But I don't think I saw him in the trailer.
It's just got
either.
Lots of just attractive teenagers.
It's like new Twister, and that's basically it.
Yeah, and it's got that. There's a horrible scene at the end of the trailer where aeroplanes that are parked at the airport start flying into the air because
it's all.
I don't know if there's any sharks in this one though.
No, not so much.
You know what? I got a copy of that. At a Christmas party recently.
Sharknado.
Was
that in The Secret Santa?
Yes. Ian owns Sharknado. I don't. But I basically told everyone, I was like, if you try to steal this gift, you have to go through me.
I'm more interested in there was a Christmas party recently.
Yeah, we have a midwinter Christmas.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Anyway. Duh.
Duh. Number two, Guardians of the Galaxy. And in the number one spot... Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Is that how they sing it?
That's the theme song. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Right. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I'll have to take your word for it.
At
every stage of my development, I missed out on them when I was a teenager and a young adult. And it's like for some reason they've always either they've turned up when I don't think they're cool or. They have all the, you know, they have that long hiatus where they were, there was nothing, and now this time around it's like I didn't even know.
I have a tragic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles story, but I'll save that for another day.
Really?
Yeah.
No, we've got time.
Oh. Well, my mother is going to be mortified, but basically when I was really young, I have an older brother, so I always wanted to do boy things because like, I looked up to my older brother. And I really wanted a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles party. And apparently my parents looked at each other and were like, we need to get her some more friends who are girls. And so I think they kind of made me have a princess party. And it's like, I think I have like lasting consequences from this.
Well, we do know that your parents are regular listeners to the show. Yeah. So I'm hoping that they will write into us.
Yeah.
Rancho Notorious at funeralsandsnakes.net.
Yeah. Funny story, but Mum and Dad, why? Why did you make me conform to gender restrictions? Come on. Come on. Although now I can have whatever birthday party I want, so.
You can.
I'm an independent
woman.
Go girl.
The UK weekend box office number five, How to Train Your Dragon 2. Planes 2, Fire and Rescue, something to look forward to there at school holiday time, everybody. Number four, number three, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, two, Guardians of the Galaxy, and number one, The Inbetweeners 2. And that's coming out here very soon, isn't that on the next week? There's posters up for it all over town, The Inbetweeners 2. So we're going to be swamped, ladies and gentlemen, by hideous... British culture on the big screen, and I mean, it just makes me feel sad. I mean, I am half British by
Did we watch the first one together?
I walked out. I don't walk out of much. I walked out of the first Inbetweeners.
Maybe I saw it at a separate screening.
Yeah,
I think I've seen about. It was a TV series.
It was a TV series.
I've seen about 15 minutes of one episode, and nope.
It's The movie was traumatizing.
Yeah, so
I've seen some messed up movies, and that was. Ugh.
I think a double feature of Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie, and The Inbetweeners 2.
My eyes!
I feel this is in our future. So.
No.
And as usual, we try and cast the net. Excuse me. As usual, we try and cast the net a little bit wider. And we've gone back to Latin America for this weekend. The Uruguay box office. Just looking at the top five. Number five, Blended. Adam Sandler, popular all over the world. Number four, Deliver Us from Evil. So crappy horror movies, popular all over the world. Number three, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Number two, Guardians of the Galaxy. And the reason why I chose Uruguay is because there actually does appear to be some Spanish language films in their top ten. Number one in Uruguay, Socios por Accidente, which is an Argentinian thriller. A sort of about a drug deal gone wrong, as far as I could work out from the trailer in Spanish on YouTube. But also there is in fact a film from Uruguay in the top 10, a film called Mr. Kaplan at number 6, and down at number 23 at the very bottom of our list for Uruguay there is an Argentinian comedy called Bañeros 4. That means there's been three others of these. Bañeros 4, Los Rompeolos.
That's a great title.
It's an awesome title, and even more
especially when you say it. Los Rompeolos.
It's set at the trailer seems to be set at a beach. It's like a kind of '80s Baywatch comedy.
Is it actually called like The Romp? Is that what I feel like that's what it translates to.
We need Spanish people. We need a resident language expert to help me through all of this, and also get the pronunciation.
I'll look it up.
You could. While you're there. Equally impressive as that title is the fact that it made $177 last weekend at the Uruguay box office. Isn't it amazing how little money actually gets made in some of these places? Either they, like the number one film in Uruguay was Socios por Accidente, is only on 7 screens. There's just not that many cinemas around. We are so lucky here in New Zealand, which, you know, in lots of ways is a kind of backwater, let's be honest. But cinematically, we are definitely not. Have I padded long enough until you could find more information?
I'm almost there. I just have to put into Google Translate.
I'll spell it for you. Los, L-O-S.
It translates into breakwaters.
Ah, breakwaters. That's not quite as interesting as we could.
The Romp 4.
Who are you? Are you a murderer? Are you a mercenary who turns his back on the innocent? We believe in you. We have faith in you. Remember the deeds you have performed. The labors you have accomplished. Are you only the legend, or are you the truth? Behind the legend. Now, tell me. Who are you? I am Hercules!
The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and Hercules, a role you would think that he was born to play.
Mm.
You know, it's not every time that a kid who went to primary school at Richmond Road Primary in Auckland gets to be the son of a god, a demigod. But he's
got the pecs for it.
He's got all of it. Seriously.
All of it, really. Is there like a full front scene?
No, I was thinking...
Pass!
No, yeah. What amazes me about the muscles of these really big guys is what happens around the shoulder area up into the neck.
Mm.
You know, it's like, I don't even know what you would do to actually build those. I can sort of understand what happens with biceps and arms and all that sort of stuff, but
his thighs were ridiculous. He's wearing a little loincloth thing and they're like bulging out the side of it. It's insane.
I'm so excited.
Mark and I went to see this film last night, and you know, it's been out for a couple of weeks. It's, you know, slid under the radar of a lot of people, but it is the kind of film that will always find an audience. I mean, The Rock is a very popular movie star. This is, I guess, a twist on the Hercules legend that we're sort of familiar with, I guess, in that the twist is he's not really a demigod. He is, in fact, just an ordinary bloke, big ordinary bloke, who has built a legend for himself in order to be more valuable as a mercenary. So he's traveling around Greece, solving people's problems, winning their wars for them, fighting their fights for them, and he can command a higher price, you know. And he's also more likely to scare off the enemy if they think he's actually the son of Zeus. And I don't think that constitutes a spoiler, does it? Because it's actually pretty much in everything that I've read about it. And he has a band of warriors with him, so it's who help him fight his battles. He ends up in Thrace, where John Hurt, who is the king of this particular part of Greece, is suffering a little bit of rebellion trouble, and he enlists Hercules and his team to try and fight him off. So in some ways, it's kind of like a cross between The Magnificent Seven and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, isn't it? You know, if you know your movie history. And in fact, there's not a moment of the film, there's not a scene in the film that hasn't happened somewhere else in some other kind of movie. There's not much that's original apart from this little twist that they've added. What did you make of it as spectacle, Matt?
It's far from the worst thing I've ever seen. I think it does what it sets out to do reasonably well. It's not super long, which was nice. That's what you're saying about it all seeming very familiar. That to me seems to be what Brett Ratner does. He just takes things from other movies and brings them into his own thing. So it can be a stylistic thing, like with Red Dragon, he just basically copied the style of Silence of the Lambs. In this movie, there's Star Wars in it, there's a lot of Troy and Gladiator, obviously. But yeah, it's far from the worst thing that he's done.
Yeah, I had that's such faint praise.
It really is.
I had quite a few problems with it. Again, you know, we were just talking about, I've walked out of the in-betweeners. You know, I have been known to just cut my losses on these things, and I didn't feel like doing that last night. You know, there's a strong supporting cast full of sort of solid British actors, including Joseph Fiennes, who you don't see very often, and looking very much like his brother, actually. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder if he's like that much cheaper.
Something must have gone wrong in his career, because he only ever shows up in these kind of parts nowadays.
I know, exactly. And yet, you know, there he was in the time of Shakespeare in Love. He was the next big thing for a while. So, yeah, he made some wrong turns. But John Hurt's in it, and Rufus Sewell. But it seems as if no one, apart from maybe Dwayne Johnson himself, nobody's heart's really in this. And Ratner's doesn't seem to be, because the action isn't particularly stylishly shot. It doesn't appear to be, you know, there's a bit of banter between those characters, a bit sort of, you know, Dirty Dozen-ish and what have you, but, you know, it never really comes to life, it seems to me.
That's, I think, the worst thing about this movie, is that I don't think I'm going to remember seeing it in a week. It's just like anything else that comes and goes.
I'll be interested to know what you think about the tone of it, and this is something that I think is a big problem with lots of films these days, is that this is a film that's rated M, so effectively anybody can go. You don't need to be accompanied by a parent or guardian. The Rock's a big hero to young people. This is, you know, Hercules is a great story that a lot of kids would be familiar with and want to see, and we were very close to taking the 11-year-old who lives with us to the film last night. He had piano lessons, unfortunately, so couldn't come with us. And I'm glad, because actually it was not suitable for an 11-year-old, the story was, you know, there's a lot of aspects of the story that you could explain to a 9 to 11-year-old and they would totally get it. But the way that it was shot, and the gore and the blood and the violence, just takes it beyond what I think I would be comfortable taking a kid to.
Sure, yeah, it's nasty, and the violence in it kind of, to me, goes against what he was trying to do by demystifying Hercules, because to make Hercules be a real man, and all through the movie there's these elements where you think there's mythological stuff, but it turns out there's not. So there's one particular big battle scene about halfway through where just dozens and dozens of people are being killed. They are pretty strange-looking characters. They're painted a bit green, so you think there might be something supernatural about them, which is the way that a lot of movies will get away with killing lots of people by making them aliens
or zombies or whatever. Yeah.
But it does that in this movie and you think, oh, it's okay, they're just zombies. But then the point of the movie is there are no such things as these myths. These are real people that are being killed.
That's right. And then it completely fails to explain who they really were then and why they were there.
Yeah.
You know, if they're not supernatural, then who put them there and why were they, what was their motivation?
Yeah.
No, just completely not explained. Too difficult. Do you think that, you know, in the way that 300 a few years ago sort of brought a whole lot of life into this sort of sword and sandal thing and created a new, you know, we got TV shows like Spartacus as a result of all of that. Do you think that this is likely to spur anything else, or is this with the barrel being dredged?
No, I don't think this is going to go any further than this one movie. Like you said, The Rock, he does seem genuinely into it, and I follow The Rock on Twitter, and he's been doing a lot of press for it and tweeting photos of himself pushing incredible amounts of weights and stuff, getting ready for the role. But yeah, that's just, he's the only one, and I don't think he's well cast either, because
no, because he's taking it very, very seriously. Yeah. I think he thinks that he's in a much more of a drama. You know, this particular Hercules has suffered a massive loss, a massive trauma, and he's haunted. He is so haunted by it. And you know, his brow is seriously furrowed, pretty much all the way through it. And there's even an element of a sort of tragic, self-destructive hero. You know, that he's going to, you know, sacrifice himself because of what's gone on before. And so this is the part that The Rock's playing. He thinks he's in Shakespeare. But, you know, Brett Ratner's making a different film around him.
Yeah, there are a couple of moments where Brett Ratner's worst instincts get the better of him. There's a bit of his lowbrow kind of fratty humour comes in every now and then. But for the most part, it's just really pretty flat.
All right, now I'm gonna ask you to come up with a two-word review.
Oh gosh, rock bottom.
Oh,
yeah, but you don't get to see his bottom, as we just established a little bit earlier on. So you know, not entirely accurate there. I want to say, toga. Oh, I can't do it. See, I'm terrible at these. I'm terrible at these. I wanted to come up with a really good.
I think a really good two-word review is actually sword and sandal, like sword ampersand sandal.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Thank you for getting me out of jail there. I'm going to take a notebook to movies again. I've stopped doing it.
You know,
just
maybe,
to get my two-word reviews.
Yeah. Maybe this would have been better as a one-man stage show, based on your impression of it.
Oh, I
really
don't see that.
Yeah, I think would. That, yeah, The Rock as Hercules, you know, giving a lecture. That would be great, you know.
I'm so torn apart.
Indeed. So that's Hercules. It's been out a couple of weeks. It was actually, we were hunting around for something to review in tonight's show, and we were actually scratching around because the film festival, nobody really wants to go up against the film festival box office wise. So there are a few more opening this weekend. You know, Expendables opening today, Expendables 3. I had to explain to you that, Mark, that The Expendables actually isn't such a bad franchise at all. I mean,
yeah, I've never seen any of them.
Yeah, so probably worth a look, actually, this one. Looking forward to that. But, yeah, so apologies for those people who like to think that Rancho Notorious is actually keeping you totally, fully up to date on the cutting edge of what's being released. We've kind of let you down a little bit there. Anyway, now, there's another reason why you're here, not just to review pecs and biceps, Mark, and that is that you are the editor of a website called Cinema Aotearoa, and how long have you been managing that website? When did it first appear?
I started it in about October of last year, I think.
So not apart after the last film festival, so this is your first... attempt to try and sort of corral the entire New Zealand content of the film festival. Were you thinking?
I don't know. When I first started it, I had a blog for a while, which I would review stuff here and there, but never with any kind of regularity. And I just wanted some kind of project that would keep me going. because I just get lazy if I don't have these self-imposed deadlines. And I thought it was a reasonable idea. I couldn't see anybody else doing it, just trying to watch... I'm essentially trying to watch every New Zealand movie that I can get my hands on and just build a catalogue of reviews. It is a bit more of a task than I thought it would be, but, you know, I'm enjoying it and I'm getting to see a lot of good stuff that I may not have really sought out otherwise.
Is it just you?
Yep, just me.
Goodness me, it's a tremendous effort. And so just explain to those people listening what the raison d'etre for the site is. What's the philosophy behind it?
Like I said, I just wanted something to keep me going. But the reason
what's in it for them?
I think it's just I couldn't find a very comprehensive kind of a database of New Zealand films where you could actually find out that much about the films, like just specifically New Zealand films. Another part of it is I'm trying to approach these things completely objectively, regardless of the fact that I am from New Zealand. Like I don't want to give favorable treatment to things just because they're New Zealand movies, which, you know, is a strange, difficult kind of ethical challenge in a way, because I don't want to discourage people from seeing New Zealand cinema. I try to be honest in my own opinion about what these things are like.
And you're casting the net pretty wide. You're not just looking at the usual suspects. I was having a look at the site a little bit earlier on today, and there's that you found a copy of that that weird German sort of tourist brochure,
sure,
drama that was filmed here, and that's the first of it. There's a series of those.
You know, yeah, that's right.
Kept the Auckland film industry going for a long time. Those things. What I can't even remember what it's called, but people here in New Zealand listening will be surprised that actually there's an entire German TV movie industry based around shooting things here in New Zealand.
Yeah, I can't remember what that one was called either, actually.
But and also you know you're not going to leave here without a copy of Atomic Twister, which I've been promising you for a long time. Which is, talking of great Twister movies, this is a film shot in Huntley of all places, in which the Huntley power station plays the part of a Midwestern nuclear power station threatened by a tornado.
Wow!
Yeah. And in the days when the New Zealand dollar encouraged these sorts of runaway crappy TV movie productions, featuring Carl Lewis, the Olympic
That's
sprinter.
That's why I'm most excited about it.
Yeah, he plays a security guard. And friend of Rancho Notorious, Johnny Lee, is in
of
it as well.
Of course he's in it. It's not a New Zealand film unless he's in it.
Yeah. So, I've got a copy of that here, which you'll take away with you, and I look forward to your... to your verdict on the site. So just what is the URL and how can people find it?
It's cinema-aotearoa.co.nz. You can find me on Twitter just at cinema-aotearoa as well.
Right. And you are, of course, 10ribs27 personally on Twitter.
Yep.
It's interesting that that on the site you don't necessarily identify yourself personally with the reviews. It's the site appears to be it's anonymous, but it also appears to be kind of a Lumiere-like collective. I was kind of surprised when it turns out to be just you. Does that help when it comes to... we've outed you now, unfortunately, but does that help when it comes to reviewing New Zealand work? Because I've always found that reviewing stuff that my mates have worked on or that my mates are in or that you're also trying to do press for and do interviews with people, it's that much harder to rise above it?
When I started it, I decided to don't personalize any of the reviews. I just kind of kept my name out of it. I haven't really made any effort to hide who I am or anything. I've had a couple of messages on Twitter and on Facebook saying, I bet the Film Commission are out to get you and all this kind of thing, which seems very strange to me. I'm not trying to burn any bridges or anything like that. I just think for me, it works better just keeping it separate.
How far have you still got to go, do you think?
I think I've got... It would be close to 100 reviews now. There is a Wikipedia page of New Zealand films, which has about 200 and something, but it's not I don't know how comprehensive that is. But yeah, there is, I guess, there will be an end point with the back catalogue, which maybe I'll hit sometime. But.
Yeah. Well, the Film Commission have also, they've announced and launched their video on demand service, which has got quite a few titles on it that aren't available on home video or hard to find on home video now. So they're making, you know, a good effort at making those older titles available. That's going to help you out.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and surprisingly, like Fatso has a very good selection of New Zealand. That's where I get most of them from. I just added everything New Zealand to my queue, hit shuffle, and they just come in the mail a couple times a week. The Wellington Library has a pretty good selection of New Zealand films. There's also the Film Archive, but I can't really get there during the day to watch things, and they have certain things which nobody else would have. So yeah, once I get drain Fatso's New Zealand catalogue, then it's going to be a bit of a struggle. But.
Do you have a copy of Hamish McDowell's 100 Essential New Zealand Films, the book?
I have a couple of New Zealand film books. I can't remember what they are.
Published by Awa Press here in Wellington a few years ago. I'm just wondering whether
I know the book you mean. I don't have a copy of it.
All right, I might have a spare. I'll dig one out and see if I can. Otherwise, I found that's a really that I bought several copies of that to give as presents to people that I met while I was overseas, because it's a much more interesting guide to New Zealand film than anything that the Film Commission, the glossy coffee table books that they've produced, because it actually includes even a 48-hour film winner in 100 essential New Zealand films. It's worth digging out a copy if I'm talking to listeners here, if you can. Awa Press, I'm sure, have boxes of them still left lying around. I tried to pitch a film book to Awa Press, and they said, "Oh, film books don't sell." So I imagine they've still got quite a few, unfortunately. So cinema-aotearoa.co.nz, and it's pretty authoritative and certainly covering a lot of ground. So,
and also a very beautiful site as well,
isn't it? Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thanks. I did it all myself. I don't know anything about that kind of thing.
Oh no, it's quite nice.
I just found an easy do-it-yourself website builder, basically.
Well, don't give away too many trade secrets. No. It's a very attractive looking site and lots of fantastic content. We're going to direct people there. The link will be in the show notes. It's time for some news.
Thank you.
And we start off with the NZFF news as per usual. Even though you're still only, you've only got how many days have you got left?
Just under a week, actually, because I fly to Canada next Wednesday. So I'm going to be on the show, but overseas. It's going to be very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. This is me being less than enthusiastic about that prospect. I mean, it's great that you're going overseas. Wonderful. But it's not going to be the same.
No. Well, it'll be good. It'll be good. Lots of exciting news because...
You're going to a bacon festival.
I'm going to a bacon festival. Yeah, if people don't know already, because I've been tweeting about it nonstop, I'm going to Canada because a family member is having an exciting event that I'm going to.
Facebook calls a life event.
A life event, yeah. I don't want to give too much away in case people are invited. then I'm going to Telluride. I'm going to be volunteering at Telluride this year. Very excited. And then I'm going to Chicago for a week. I'm going to train there, taking my very first ever train trip to Chicago. In Chicago, I am going to go to the Great American Bacon Festival. And then I am going up to Toronto, and actually just by chance, the Toronto Film Festival will be on, so I will have enough money to get one ticket. Fingers crossed that'll be the Deadlands. So.
Oh, wow. That would be fantastic. And of course, while you're in Chicago, you should go and inspect the post-Transformers rebuild, because it was destroyed by giant robots not that long ago.
True story. In NZIF news, Auckland and Wellington have ended their run, but as of today, we have 5 festivals running now. Very exciting. So currently on the festival circuit, there is Gore, which opened last night with Housebound. Awesome.
Oh my God, that would be so cool.
We have Timaru, which is part of the NZIF for, I believe, the first time this year. We have Nelson, Christchurch, and Dunedin.
All happening at the same time.
All happening at the same time.
How do you cope?
Hashtags. All about the hashtags.
Is there a cinema in Goa?
Yeah, there's the SBS St. James Theatre. A friend of mine actually... Oh, he doesn't... I think he is on the board that helps manage it, but he's sort of their tech guy, so... Mm. Yes, there is one. There's one. It's right downtown. It's great.
I haven't been to Goa in many years.
Mm. They have a fully digital as well.
Wow.
DCP. Mm. Yep. Mm. What else at NZIF News? If you're in any of those regions, make sure to get along to screenings. There's lots of great titles. I can't say them off the top of my head because every region is a little bit different. Mm. But definitely check out nziff.co.nz.
And actually, another tip is... To go back to previous last week's episode of this show, where we put a whole lot of links in the show notes to places like Lumiere, to the listeners' festival coverage, and to Radio New Zealand's festival coverage. So you can get lots of tips there about things to watch when they come to your region.
Mm-hmm. And if you are in the larger centres, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, there are other festivals that are coming up a little bit later on down the road. And if there's something you can't get to, road trip. Hamilton's not that far away.
Yeah, good.
She says from good. Wellington.
Yeah, well, and when you said there are other festivals, I was actually thinking, there's actually a few other festivals coming up. We could have gone to the media launch for the German Film Festival this evening, but we decided to stay here instead. So I got an invitation today to a sort of random get together for the French Film Festival, which I don't even think they're announcing anything. I think they're just taking over the Cordon Bleu.
Let's joint drink wine and eat some cheese.
Yeah, basically.
Nice.
I know.
Nice.
So yeah, so lots of festivals coming up between now and next year's NZIF.
Moving on to some slightly sadder news, the shocking and sudden passing of Robin Williams dominated film news this week. There isn't much we can add to what's already out there, and Rancho Notorious doesn't condone the unnecessary speculation about Mr. Williams' private circumstances at the time. But this is an opportunity to reach for each of us to talk about what Robin Williams meant to us as filmgoers.
Yeah, I thought that it would be disrespectful of us to not recognise his passing. What was the first Robin Williams film that you saw?
Oh, I remember seeing Hook in the cinema, and I also saw Toys in the cinema. They would have been around about the same time, but
I think Mrs. Doubtfire was my first one.
Yeah, I can't remember what the first one of his I would have seen. I think I probably saw Good Morning Vietnam when I was pretty young, just on TV one night or something like that. But I remember loving Hook and Toys when I was a kid. In hindsight, they're not really such great movies. But yeah, he has done a lot of really, really good things. World's Greatest Dad a couple of years ago.
Which I still haven't seen. Is it as good as everybody says?
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah. Mm. And dark, but really good.
Yeah, and his dramatic stuff, like 48 Hour Photo?
Oh, 1 Hour Photo.
Well, sorry, 1 Hour Photo was incredible. Like, it just felt like that one came out of left field.
Well, actually, 2002, I was talking to Radio New Zealand today about that and looking at 2002 and seeing that was a year where 1 Hour Photo, Death to Smoochie, and Insomnia all came out in the same year. And everybody's attitude to Robin Williams changed, and he went from being the sort of the Patch Adams soft and sentimental guy to reinventing himself. My number one Robin Williams film still Good Will Hunting, and I realized as I've come back to that film and watched it again that actually that film wouldn't have been made without him. And there have been so many stories this week about people who wouldn't have careers if he hadn't. There's a wonderful article by or a post, I guess you'd call it, not online, by David Simon, who created The Wire, talking about how his first TV show, Homicide, he hadn't even quit his day job as a journalist. He'd written a script for the first season of that. It hadn't been shot. They'd moved it into the second season, but the show was about to be cancelled. And Barry Levinson, who was a producer on that show, used his connections to Robin as an old mate, asked Robin Williams to guest star in a totally dramatic role that nobody would have known him for. And so many people watched that show that it basically got renewed and got four or five more seasons. And as a result, David Simon got to quit his job and become a TV writer, which meant that we got The Wire, you know. So I'll put the link to that story in the show notes, because I think it's sort of symptomatic of the kind of effect that Williams had. You know, one of my favourite stories is he did an interview, because he was here doing stand-up in 2010, did a stand-up tour in Auckland and Christchurch, and he did an interview with the New Zealand Herald where he said basically he had to do big stand-up shows to pay for, you know, his lifestyle. He was doing lots of independent movies. They weren't always getting released. And, you know, he wasn't getting those big jobs anymore. So he was doing stand-up to pay the bills. And then, of course, he gets to Christchurch and donates all of the takings to earthquake relief. You know, it's like with one hand he was going, I need to do this to pay my bills, and then couldn't kind of bring himself to do it, you know. He was at Juilliard. He was a roommate of Christopher Reeve's.
Hmm.
They studied there together. And when Christopher Reeve had his accident, Robin Williams paid for everything from that moment on.
Wow.
You know, all the medical care that he needed, Robin Williams paid for. So incredibly generous, and yeah, lots of things that just wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
If there are people listening who haven't seen Good Will Hunting, then, you know, that's your weekend task. I expect you to seek it out one way or another.
And then maybe Jumanji.
One photo as well. One photo was...
Yeah.
And then throw Jumanji in there because it's great.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, there's just so many, and they really are, so, you know, performances that only he could have given. It's a long time. I haven't seen Dead Poets Society since it came out, but that's the one that I'm going to be seeking out this weekend to sit and watch.
Mm. And at the age of 89, her passing from a stroke wasn't nearly as shocking as Robin Williams, but this world is mourning and celebrating Lauren Bacall just the same. Her career started in 1944 when she was plucked from a teenage modeling career to appear opposite Humphrey Bogart in To Have and Have Not.
That's another one that people need to go and see this weekend if you can't. If you haven't already.
Mm-hmm. Mm. They fell in love and the rest is history. The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo with Bogart followed. He died in 1957 and she lived for 56 years without him, also marrying Jason Robards from 1961 to 1969. She was still working. Her voice graces Ernest and Celestine, as well as an upcoming episode of Family Guy.
Yeah.
I'm so sad her last work will be Family Guy.
Yeah, IMDb says there's one title in production, so you know, the top of that list won't be the Family Guy episode. But as far as I'm concerned, I want to still be working at 89. I want to still be racking up credits. And as somebody said to me today, the our last connection to the golden age of Hollywood, really. Mm. You know, Eli Wallach passed away not long ago, and. So, you know, there we go. The last person who really remembered what it was like to be a movie star.
Mm.
Mm. And the New Zealand contingent at Toronto grew during the week as it was announced that The Dark Horse, as exclusively revealed here at Rancho Notorious 2 weeks ago, and What We Do in the Shadows joined previously announced The Deadlands. I'm going to be busy.
You are going to be busy. And we're going to expect you to be reporting back on your activities in Toronto.
I don't... I think I might just... I don't even know if I'll be able to get in. I might just wander around and be like, hey, TIFF is on. It seems pretty, like, intense.
And from what I understand...
The full schedule isn't even announced yet. Like, they announce the schedule, and then tickets go on sale 2 weeks later, and then, like, 4 days later, the festival opens. It's insane.
Yeah, and my understanding also from last year is that it's actually really it seems really disorganized, actually, on the ground. And lots of things start late. Like, they're just, you know, queues, they can't seat everybody, film start late, pushes back the schedule, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, and, you know, it's just chaotic in a way that, you know, we're very lucky here in New Zealand that the New Zealand International Film Festival, you know, is a very smooth running machine, but most film festivals in the world are not, I think it would be fair to say. You know, we've got great ushers at our cinema. You know, stuff starts on time.
Mm.
So, I was just having a look at what's coming out on video this week, and new video releases for home, either through Fatso, as Mark's alluded to, or your local video store, or video on demand. The Great Beauty is on Blu-ray and DVD this week. God's Pocket, which is a film that didn't get a cinema release, but is one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last performances, directed by John Slattery from Mad Men.
Was it?
Yeah. And Pantani, The Accidental Death of a Cyclist. Anybody know? That looked like it's a documentary about the Tour de France, but it looks pretty interesting.
It's like the center of the Tour de France.
Yeah, and another sports movie, Next Goal Wins, which is about the American Samoan World Cup football team, the worst team in the world, and following them on their efforts to qualify for Brazil. So those are out on video this weekend. A little bit earlier on this morning, I spoke to an old friend of the previous podcast that we used to do, and this one, Glenn Kenny, former deputy editor of Premier Magazine and now a contributor to RogerEbert.com and VanityFair.com, as well as his own website, which we'll link to in the show notes. He's just released a book called Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and I spoke to him this morning about that book. Joining us at Rancho Notorious on the line via Skype from Brooklyn, New York, we have Glenn Kenny. Glenn, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thank you, Dan. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Glenn, you've got a new book out, and it's in shops, and I can testify to this, all around the world. Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and it's from the prestigious Cahiers du Cinéma imprint. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this project, and because I didn't even realize that Cahiers du Cinéma was still a thing.
Well, Cahiers du Cinéma actually does still publish a magazine, and I'm not exactly sure about how explicit the editorial links between the French magazine and the book publishing imprint are. The actual structure of the corporate entity is somewhat mysterious to me, but long story short, the art book publisher Phaidon and Cahiers du Cinéma have kind of merged to create an imprint that is putting out film books in different formats. They tend to be formatted series of books rather than most standalone things. There's a Masters of Cinema line, which is in paperback, and which is these consist of monographs about different directors. And the Anatomy of an Actor series, of which there are, I think, six at the moment or more, are large format, heavily illustrated books in which the author looks at the career of a given actor through the prism of 10 specific films, which the author picks. Now, I came to write the De Niro book on account of a woman who was then an editor at Cahiers Phaidon, Valerie Buffet, who has since been kicked upstairs, came to New York, and the French filmmaker and critic Nicolas Sada very kindly gave my name to her. So I was one of the people she was interviewing in New York. We were discussing book ideas. I was just sort of freestyling. I said, well, I'm fascinated by the life and work of the director, the American director Richard Quine. I'd love to do a biography of him. And that was deemed somewhat impractical for reasons of obscurity and, that was pretty much it. And Valerie told me about the Anatomy of an Actor books, and she mentioned Robert De Niro, and I thought, well, yes, because he's an actor I grew up watching. I'm a great enthusiast of the Martin Scorsese films, and it's an interesting career arc, and I'd already done some writing about De Niro. I'd done some writing for MSN Movies, the website which I was then working for, about the idea that, you know, despite the fact that what we see of Robert De Niro's work currently is not necessarily what we'd like to see, Robert De Niro doesn't really owe us anything at this point, you know. And I thought that the book, the format that the Anatomy of an Actor books gave me a unique opportunity to kind of expand upon that idea. by you know, choosing 10 films in a career arc that actually encompassed the things that people find disappointing about De Niro's career. A lot of people of my generation who were introduced to De Niro through the likes of Mean Streets and so on are put off by, say, the comic persona that he shows in Meet the Parents, and even more so by what goes on in those film sequels. So I thought it would be interesting to, A, look at what he does and what he has done through the course of a career, and even as far back as 1995, a critic as astute as Gilbert Adair was writing stuff that reflected a certain agnosticism about De Niro and his work. And I thought to write about our tendency to mythologize actors and why that can be a somewhat not really constructive way of looking at acting, and also just to really celebrate a body of work that's amazing and also in some respects slightly misunderstood. So I came up with a list of films, and I didn't hear from them for a little while, but then I heard from them in the spring of 2013 when I got the go-ahead to write the book, and I just sort of dove in head first in terms of De Niro research. I found that Amazon Instant Video was a really turned into a really useful research tool, because there's a good deal of material from De Niro's early days, movies like The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight and Ivan Pastor's Born to Win, that I could just watch for free. People have not celebrated streaming video as a research tool enough. And so that got me on my way.
Right. And did you reach your conclusions about your list of 10 early on in the piece? How long did it take before you sort of narrowed that down?
It was interesting because there was some, I wouldn't say controversy is too strong a word, but when I first submitted my list, which ended up being the list that I treat in the book, there was some inquiries as to why I hadn't included Heat, which is, you know, a terrific gangster, cops and robbers, you know, sort of postmodern cops and robbers picture directed by Michael Mann, which represents a kind of a 70s American actors summit because of the big scene in the middle of the film between Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, who worked in the same film in The Legendary Godfather Part II, but never met because their narrative timelines took place in completely different eras. You know, people had been waiting for a De Niro-Pacino summit since The Godfather Part II. Heat represents that. Why aren't I going to write about Heat? My rationale was twofold. First off, I thought that as good a film as Heat is, it's not really a defining... it's not a defining moment in De Niro's career the way even something like Meet the Parents was. It's more like a consummation devoutly to be wished comes true in that movie, but it's not, it doesn't advance his career one way or another. It's almost like the inevitable finally happens, and it's good, but it's more, you know, the dynamic of that film is so controlled by Michael Mann that it's not as if the De Niro-Pacino scene breaks out of it in any significant way. The other reason for my excluding it was my suspicion, which turned out to be correct, that it was a film that Carina Longworth would treat in her own Anatomy of an Actor book on Al Pacino, which she did. And I think it's more significant as an Al Pacino film than as a Robert De Niro film. Mm. Now, I have a sidebar in the book that talks about the Heat and the scene between the two, but I think that's actually very appropriate. So once I convinced the editors that my list was the most representative, and it was tough because you leave out so much. You
know? I was going to suggest that the one notable omission from my point of view is The Deer Hunter, which when I was a kid, that was the one that was the film that that. When I saw De Niro, I didn't see De Niro. You know, it was like I didn't know actors could do that.
No, it's true, and that was a tough call to make. And I just felt that I needed those four Scorsese pictures. If I could have gotten rid of Mean Streets and substituted Deer Hunter, maybe I would have done that. But I mean, to get rid of Mean Streets is a real issue. Yeah. So it became kind of painful. And but I felt like I couldn't not have Godfather Part II. I couldn't not have King of Comedy, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, and Mean Streets. And I really needed to start with Bang the Drum Slowly, because that really was the movie where critics started noticing him. And it's an interesting performance, because it's a performance before the De Niro persona was really formed in people's minds. So to see him as this, you know, kind of redneck, you know, not the redneck of Max Cady and Cape Fear, but a genuinely ingenuous redneck, it speaks to his acting craft at that point in time that is mastered by the time you see Deer Hunter. You know, it's tough, and I know that, you know, some people will object, just as some people have objected to the omission of Ronan. But yeah, Deer Hunter, you know, it's tough choices.
Let's talk a bit about the Scorsese quartet and what that partnership between those two guys meant for each other and for the development of the De Niro persona and that. And the mythology that you know you talk about.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, because I look at the entirety of the De Niro filmography and the Scorsese De Niro filmography, and I come to a conclusion that's a little disquieting, which is that, you know, De Niro's effectiveness in a film is directly proportionate to the originality and effectiveness of the film itself. You know, he's not the kind of performer where you will watch the, I mean, some people will do this, but he doesn't ever save a movie. you know, he's not the kind of performer you will watch just to see him in the movie. If the movie doesn't work, he does not automatically redeem it. Mm. You know, Ilya Kazan's The Last Tycoon is not a bad film, but it doesn't get where it wants to go. And everybody's putting their best foot forward, and De Niro is trying really hard, Kazan's trying really hard. They have the disadvantage of a script by Harold Pinter. You know, Harold Pinter is just kind of like the wrong sensibility to adapt F. Scott Fitzgerald, who is a much more direct kind of writer. So you have this kind of emotionally stunted conception of the story, and they just can't break out of it. And De Niro's performance can't break free of it. And there's other performances and other films where they just can't capture the certain spark that they're looking for. And you can watch it and everybody's good in it, but it's not as if, you know, wow, he really saves the picture. Mm-hmm. So the thing about the first four, the four that I treat, you know, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, King of Comedy, I omit New York, New York, which is, you know, it's glib to call New York, New York an interesting failure. I don't think it's a failure, but it's a different kind of movie, and it's a movie where a lot of what De Niro does is subjugated to the mise-en-scene and to Liza Minnelli's character and so on. He's actually not the most interesting thing about the film for some reason. Those four films are a real, just incredible distillation of what Scorsese was trying to convey in cinema early on, and the way that De Niro was the perfect vehicle for a lot of what he was doing. And it's particularly true in Raging Bull, which is, you know, Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and King of Comedy are all very unusual films. You know, I quote Pauline Kael expressing disapprobation about King of Comedy, complaining that it doesn't ever let you think that you're watching a normal movie. And the reason that it is doing that is because it's really not a normal movie. In a way, these De Niro-Scorsese collaborations are irrational films that are more like visual poems than straight conventional narratives. they're very inconsistent and you know, inconsistent in the conventional senses that we want films to be consistent. Mm. So I think that not just De Niro's incredible virtuosic acting, but his willingness to go along with these concepts that are very unusual in Hollywood films, even by the standards of the freedom that Hollywood films was enjoying at the time. Those were why those films were so important to me and why those films were so important to explore.
I've read your chapter on Midnight Run, which has been extracted on a website. Is it the Roger Ebert .com website? And so listeners who maybe aren't able to track the book down immediately can get a taster there at RogerEbert.com. And it's and Midnight Run is a film that I have a great deal of fondness for. And in fact, New Zealanders, if they paid much attention, should be very fond of it as well, because the whitewater drenching sequence in Midnight Run was actually shot here in the South Island because it was warmer.
Yeah, they needed to get someplace where the guys wouldn't freeze to death.
Exactly, and I seem to remember
they had the budget to do it.
Yeah, and I remember stories about how De Niro arrived at Christchurch Airport completely unrecognized and unmolested by anybody. He would have been one of the biggest movie stars in the world at that point, or certainly one. It should have been one of the most recognizable faces from a career point of view. But even then, he had that ability to sort of disappear into the background, and nobody knew anything about it until after it had happened.
And yet, according to Charles Grodin, even in Christchurch, De Niro was such a food enthusiast that he knew the best restaurant to go to, the name of the maitre d', all that stuff. Actually, he was not such a big star at that point. He wasn't what you'd call a bankable movie star, and Midnight Run helped make him a bankable movie star. I think when I was a little disappointed with that film when I watched it for the purposes of writing the book, and I think I underestimated the extent to which people still view that film very, very, very affectionately. I think that the interplay between Charles Grodin and De Niro is fantastic and absolutely the best thing about it. I found that some of the hijinks were a little, felt a little forced. But, you know, it's a really... It's a really terrific role for De Niro, because he does get to slightly spoof the conventions of the you know, buddy film fish out of water genre,
and also the hard man that he was he had a reputation for playing. He managed to spoof that pretty effectively as well.
Yeah, he does a very working class take on it. You know, when he's gloating over stealing Yaphet Kotto's sunglasses. It's a very much. I think people love his character because he's a tough man who's also you know, kind of an underdog.
I want to talk to you a bit now about De Niro the comedian, because I think that that's perhaps one of the things that about his career development that I think has flummoxed people who are familiar with that sort of 1970s canon. You know, it was how. Was how gifted a comedian he was. I remember watching him in Brazil in a cameo, and he was just hysterically funny, brilliant timing, and all in the service of a really sort of detailed and thorough characterization. And you know, you have a chapter on Meet the Parents in your book. And I took an actor friend of mine to see the sequel to that, Meet the Fockers. And sure. An actor friend of mine who was very down on De Niro, didn't really want to go, had felt like he had been abandoned by De Niro 10 years before, and you know, thought that he was just cashing paychecks. And we sat there and we watched Meet the Fockers, and we saw the hardest working man in show business. On the screen there, he worked his ass off to make that to make that film and to carry that film.
He brings, you know, he brings it, and he's in terms of the De Niro as comic actor, you know, he's funny in Mean Streets. I mean, until he turns really insane. There's that whole scene in the back room of the bar where Keitel's Charlie and De Niro's Johnny Boy are talking about the money that De Niro owes, and De Niro's Johnny Boy is spelling out this, you know, this long-winded excuse. I was gambling with this guy, you know, Joey Clems, Joey Scala, same guy, you know, and they're doing this thing, and it's like an Abbott and Costello routine. It's very funny.
And I guess the current state of Mr. De Niro's career, it's knowing a lot of actors as I do, I know that actors love to act, you know, and they get itchy if they're not acting. And, you know, he's working a lot, and he's working a lot in films that maybe lots of people think are kind of unworthy of him. But I think a lot of audiences kind of don't necessarily appreciate what it is for an actor to be not working.
Oh, no, because, you know, for as many films as you do, you've been rejected 5,000 times, more than that. And I'm sure that's true of De Niro. You know, he likes to work. I had a similar, you know, when I was encountered Christopher Walken during my premiere days. I had a long interview with him, and it was during the period where, you know, he was popping up in pretty much everything, and it was a huge eclectic amount of he'd be in an Abel Ferrara film, and then he'd be co-starring with The Rock in something.
Yeah, we watched him in Mouse Hunt on Saturday night, actually, with the 11-year-old who lives with us, and there he was stealing another film.
Sure, and he says, you know, it's very simple. I like to work. This is my job. I like to work, and I enjoy work that's physically engaging. And if my schedule's open and I can do it, I'm there. You know, De Niro's not quite as pragmatic that way, because De Niro is also an entrepreneur and a businessman, and he is involved in a lot of things. And you know, his income. The income that he generates, the revenue he generates from being in films, is actually income that he turns around and puts into his entrepreneurial projects in a lot of cases. So there's that. You know, he talks about, I have some quotes at the end of the book where he talks about his impetus for working as much as he does. He doesn't really say this out loud, you know, he doesn't say this explicitly, but you know, he had prostate cancer in the early part of the 2000s, and he recovered from that. And I think he feels that, he says, I need to work while I can work. And that's just how he feels. And, you know, he says, talking about a film like New Year's Day, which people think, why is he wasting his time with that? Well, you know, he says the deal was good. He knows Gary Marshall. He likes Gary Marshall. So he was able to do it, so he did it. And for actors, there's no shame in that. In fact, that's the whole point, is to work.
Yeah. Glenn Canny, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and having you here at Rancho Notorious. Best of luck with the book, Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and future projects too.
Hey, Dan, thank you very much.
De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, is available locally through Penguin Books, and a copy will cost you $70, and it's in hardback. We'll see if we can get a prize copy. I'll talk to Penguin, actually, and see if we can get one to give away. That's my task for the next few days, see if we can squeeze a copy of a book out of a publisher. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, who the heck knows? It's goodbye, Kaylee, next week.
And not
au revoir, Kaylee.
Yeah, not like get out.
No, well,
so I'm not going anywhere. Well, I mean, I'm going overseas, but I'm not losing the show.
I'm not going anywhere, she says, having just told us about the bacon festival. Yes.
Yeah, the bacon festival. That's really why I'm going. It's all about the bacon festival.
We're going to be recording early, but releasing around about the same time. So who knows what will be in the show around the all of that.
And then in 2 weeks' time, I will be able to review things again.
Yeah.
So exciting.
For those of you who've been tuning in every week thinking, what does Kaylee think?
Yeah, why doesn't Dan let her review films?
You better have a stash of two-word reviews.
Dude, they're just building up. I'm just going to explode with all like, these are things I loved. be great.
If you've enjoyed this episode, and I'm sure you have, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us. We've been receiving your emails, and you can comment on the website as well. We're live in the iTunes store for subscriptions. Our iPhone and Android apps are... Yeah, I know I said this last week, but they are closed.
Every week I'm like, did you just not forget to edit the script?
Well, it's a little bit of both, actually. I didn't edit the script, but also I haven't had a chance to go and actually fill out the forms.
It was festival. It's festival time.
It's not just festival, but in case people are a little bit behind the eight ball, I've had glandular fever. So I am...
How are you feeling now?
Rough, I can tell you, actually. And this is one of this time of the week, the fourth day of the week, is when I start to think, oh, you know what? I'm really not looking forward to work tomorrow because I still have to do the day job. I've cut back on as much as I can, but, you know, the day job, the magazine will not edit itself, unfortunately. So, and of course, you know, I asked people to donate money for this podcast. I can't, much as I would like to go, you know what, can we do this in like 3 months' time when I'm feeling better? No, exactly. So here we are, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sacrificing my health on...
Loving being here, by the way, listeners. It's great, and thank you for paying for it. Don't feel sad about it.
No, exactly. Here we are.
But of course, I don't have to edit this.
So... Yes, apologies for the fact that the various things that have been promised, apps, etc., are not yet live. I want to apologise to Letterboxd, because every week I say that we're on Letterboxd and I haven't done anything about that either yet. So, but there are other ways of getting in touch with us via social media. You're our online expert.
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word. We will be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. More incessantly.
Pretty much retweeting is what we do.
Yeah, more incessantly now that my current job will be ending and I'll be overseas, so I'll have a bit more time to focus and chat with everybody.
Conversations with listeners is always the best part of the show, really.
It is. And you'll be able to interact with us on Letterboxd sometime in the future with the username Notorious.
Yeah, I did that part. We've got the username. Oh, we have followers. I just haven't posted anything, unfortunately. Sorry about that. But, you know, maybe that's something that you could do when you come back from your... No, that's weeks away. I'm not going to wait till that long. I'll have to do it. If you need a job doing, you got to do it yourself.
There's a Letterboxd app I can just like put in.
There's not.
You could be doing.
Apparently, there's one coming.
No, but actually,
I'm going to speak with Matthew.
Their mobile site is so awesome that you don't need an app. So what we could do is, while you're sitting in airports, waiting, you could be updating our Letterboxd.
That's profile. The NZIF news that I forgot about, and I'm going to plug it now. Because this has to do with Letterboxd and the team at Cactus Lab, is the NZIF website was nominated for the New Zealand Best Award for Best Interactive Design on a large scale website. That is my big news for NZIF this week. Sorry, I forgot about it.
Well, we got it in there. We snuck it under the line just before we finished. Anyway, the show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 has been executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Los Plantronics, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. Here's the intriguingly titled alternative ending from the soundtrack of Hercules. It's written by Fernando Velazquez. Thank you very much to our guests, to Mark and to Glenn. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
Thanks, guys.
And you're moving to Auckland very soon, aren't you?
Yeah, 2 weeks this weekend. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're lucky that we got you here before you moved. For those of you listening outside of New Zealand, we're a Wellington-based podcast. And Rancho Notorious is in Newtown in Wellington. And Auckland is 8 hours' drive away, so the chances of you just being able to drop in for to appear on the show and have dinner afterwards, slender. Thanks very much to all of you for listening. We're off to have some dinner. That's good night from me.
And good night from me.